So we're back for another episode of Black Diplomats. I'm your host, Terrell Starr, and I do hope that y'all are enjoying this new video version. And if you are listening on Apple Podcast or Spotify, go over to Black Diplomats Official. The link is in the show notes, and you can watch me and my guests talk about Ukraine and all the other issues that's happening in the world. And today I have a special guest on the pod this week, my good friend Olga Tokariuk, and she's a Ukrainian journalist, and she's covered politics and other topics in her homeland and is currently a Chatham House Fellow in London. We have a lot to talk about, but I just want to ask, how you doing?
Good, good. Thank you, Terrell. Really nice to be back on your pod.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, I like to do a mental health check, and given all of the painful stuff that's going on in the world, we all need to check in with each other. So I want to ask you, how are you doing from a mental health standpoint?
Well, this week I decided I need to return to therapy. Had some really difficult episodes in recent weeks, ahead of the anniversary of the full-scale invasion. All the memories and all the current uncertainty of the situation just really felt under a lot of pressure because of that. And this week I learned that my cousin has been killed in the war. So it really hits close to home, you know, in addition to everything else that is happening. But when you're a family member, you're losing a family member. This is really something that, yeah, was a last drop for me. And then, yeah, I'm returning to therapy. So hopefully my mental health will be better. At least I'll get some support.
I'm happy. Thank you very much for sharing that. I'm really sorry for your loss. So many Ukrainians have lost loved ones in this Russian invasion, this second Russian invasion in 10 years. And I think it's really important for us to talk about therapy. Do you think a lot of Ukrainians are seeking therapy, and is that an option that's available to a lot of folks? Because in the United States, and we're not dealing with an invasion, but, you know, mental health treatment and finding it treatment that works for us, that's culturally competent, can be challenging. So I'm interested in what that is like for you as a Ukrainian woman and the rest of the Ukrainians who are in Ukraine that also need mental health support.
Yeah, I think it really depends where you are. I know that there is a lot of demand inside Ukraine for mental health support of people who are still there, you know, who are living under Russian missiles and drones. And I think that the demand there really outweighs the support, the supply. Also because there is some mental health support for free, which is an offer, but it is not enough to match the demand. And not all Ukrainians, unfortunately, have the means to pay for therapy if it is not for free. In that sense, maybe Ukrainian refugees abroad depends again on the country. They might even be better positioned because in some countries, like in the UK, you can get access to a state-funded mental health support. That's, for example, something I applied for here in the UK. I haven't tested it yet, but I will. But at least, you know, I'm happy that I have this opportunity to reach out. I think a lot of Ukrainians need that, and the demand outweighs the supply. But of course, there are still some people who are not recognizing that they need mental health support because it's been such a stigmatized somehow topic for many years in Ukraine, especially for men. Reaching out for mental health support was considered unmale, something that men usually don't do. And I recognize that a lot of work has been done by Ukrainian NGOs, by some international organizations to take away that stigma and to say this is perfectly normal to reach out and say, I'm not okay, to seek mental health support. I just hope that there will be more supply.
I would agree about that, because I think that's a really under-discussed topic here in in addition to supporting Ukraine with arms and the weapons that it needs to defend itself, I'm really wondering how much of the aid that my country, America, and the West is offering for this mental health component. Because, as you know, I live in Ukraine when I'm not here in New York, and so many of the conversations revolve around people finding ways to de-stress, and people are, you know, they're limited, and I really believe that unless we deal with this mental health component in Ukraine, even after the victory, they're just going to be a whole bunch of traumatized people that are going to be presenting new challenges to their society. And we always talk about the strength of Ukrainians. We talk about how brave they are. All these things are true. But Ukrainians, like any other people in the world, are human beings.
Exactly.
And you're right. And so it just reminds me of this strength that people talk about with Black people. We survived slavery. We survived all these things. And we don't really talk about the fact that so many people didn't. And what does that mean for folks who are a part of the living, right? How do we deal with this death? How do we deal with the trauma of those who've been harmed by all of these atrocities? And it's one story about Ukraine that we don't fully discuss because we talk about the strength of Ukrainians without really tapping into the humanity of who they are.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I agree with you. And I think the other side of strength is vulnerability, right? If you are human, you can be strong, but you can be vulnerable at the same time. And just recognizing that is important because it's impossible to always be strong and courageous and brave. Sometimes you do feel vulnerable. You are vulnerable, especially if you are living in Ukraine under the Russian bombs. You are vulnerable physically, but you are vulnerable also psychologically. So I think just recognizing that, you know, it is perfectly human to be vulnerable as well as to be strong. It doesn't make one less brave or something is important. You know, I in that sense, you mentioned like talking about loss. I saw recently that one of the best, I think, Ukrainian journalist, she launched a podcast about a loss. She lost her son, not in war, actually, due to cancer, which was very quick, and he just died. I don't know, he was aged maybe 17 or 18, but it was like very, very fast. And since his death, she's been posting a lot on her social media about, you know, how she was dealing with that loss, with this very instant death. And I'm very happy in a sense that she, with some of her other colleagues, they launched this podcast on how to deal with the loss, how to deal with the grief, because she's someone people listen to. Her name is Tatiana Troshchinska. She's actually one of my role models in Ukrainian journalism. And I think it's so important to have someone, you know, to talk about their own personal experience, but also someone who is trusted, who is authoritative. And it's so relevant to so many Ukrainians now.
Absolutely. And I'm definitely thankful for you opening up to talk about this, because I always ask my guests about their mental health. And I think the more of us who talk about it, the more empowering it will be for other people. So, you know, I didn't plan
to do that, but maybe I'm feeling vulnerable today or just
sincere.
If that inspires other people to talk more openly about, you know, their struggle and how they approach the issue of mental health support, if that encourages someone to reach out and to recognize and to say, no, yes, I need that, and to get that support, then I think it's totally worth it.
Absolutely. And I thank you for being vulnerable and sharing that with us. So I want to talk to you about our 2024 presidential election. And a lot of us are scared to death. And I want to do a check-in with you all as far as what Ukrainians are thinking about Trump. So President Joe Biden, during his State of the Union address, he reiterated his support for Ukraine and he called on the GOP to stop stalling legislation that would provide Kyiv with much needed weaponry. So basically, what's really interesting about this is that during the State of the Union, Joe Biden was calling out Donald Trump, essentially, in this MAGA contingency, and House Speaker Mike Johnson was in the back kind of sitting along, kind of nodding, saying, you know, when Biden said that we pretty much need to defend ourselves against Putin, but he's stalling the bill, not even introducing it to the House floor for a vote. And, you know, also Biden called out Trump for saying that Russia could do whatever he wanted to do with NATO members who didn't pay their fair share, so to speak. So let's play that clip.
NATO was busted until I came along. I said, everybody's going to pay. They said, well, if we don't pay, are you still going to protect us? I said, absolutely not. They couldn't believe the answer. And everybody, you never saw more money pour in to Secretary General Stoltenberg. Well, I don't know if he is anymore, but he was my biggest fan. He said, all these presidents came in, they'd make a speech, they'd leave, and that was it. And they all owed money, and they wouldn't pay it. I came in, I made a speech, and I said, you got to pay up. They asked me that question. One of the presidents of a big country stood up and said, well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, will you protect us? I said, you didn't pay? You're delinquent? He said, yes, let's say that happened. No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay. You got to pay your bills.
Okay, Olga, just to let you know how scary it is about how real a possibility that Trump could be reelected, there's a new Emerson College poll that just came out on March the 7th. And it says that a survey of voters find President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump tied at 45% for the general election matchup. Now, 10% are undecided in this poll, and undecided voters are asked which candidates they lean towards. Biden's overall support increases to 51% and Trump to 49%. So that's a 2-point difference. What do you think about Trump saying this? And are Ukrainians scared shitless about the possibility of this man taking over the White House again?
I mean, I don't think Ukrainians are scared. I think they are concerned, because whatever happens, the biggest enemy will be Russia. Whoever is in the White House, it is clear that Russia is not going to stop doing what they are doing. The question is how efficient Ukraine will be in resisting, and how much ammunition and support and money Ukraine will receive to resist. So, of course, Ukrainians are concerned that there can be less support. We already see with the bill that is stuck in the Congress, that is not passing, that Ukraine is suffering a huge deficit of ammunition. And that, I think that kind of this, the prospect of Trump returning to the White House and matters getting worse is starting to dawn, not only on Ukrainians, but also on Europeans. So here in Western Europe, where I am now based, I also see a lot of concern. And here, I think, where fear is, it is here. It is in Western Europe, because Ukrainians already face an invasion and a full-scale war. Western Europe is still safe. Well, even Central Europe is still safe if we do not take into consideration Russian hybrid attacks and Russian missiles and drones occasionally falling on the territory of Poland and Romania and other neighboring countries. However, in general, it is still safe. There is no war in Central Europe. There is no war in Western Europe. But there is real fear that it might come, that NATO might disintegrate, that it might collapse if Trump comes to power, that countries, especially those bordering Russia, like the Baltic states, they can be exposed to an attack, to a conventional Russian military attack in the next several years. There has been talk by some intelligence agencies and even government officials in several European countries on the NATO level that Russia might attack NATO in the next 3 to 5 years. And I think people are starting to take that seriously, more and more seriously. So now there is this conversation, which wasn't there a year ago in Western Europe, about the possibility of a war on a European soil beyond the borders of Ukraine, so on a territory possibly of a NATO country. And there is a very kind of, I see this even like panicked, you know, a bit attempts to come up with some contingencies and to understand and to find, you know, some solutions like how Europeans should prepare for that eventuality if the US is not there, if the US umbrella of offering protection in the defense sector, first of all, to Europe is not there anymore. So we're seeing now the scramble for, you know, supporting Ukraine more. Europeans just announced that they managed to find money and collect those not 1 million artillery shells that they promised for Ukraine, but 800,000, so a figure which is close to that. And so the promise that was made by the European Union countries last year and which they failed to deliver on initially. So now, instead of 1 million, they are providing 800,000, which is better than nothing, but still is falls short of what they promised. And I think but that kind of gives you an idea of that a bit frantic attempts in Europe, in Western Europe, in Central Europe, to an increasing realization that their security depends on what happens in Ukraine. So it's better to give Ukraine what they need now. It's better to equip Ukrainians with what they need so that only Ukraine remains the territory in which war is going on, in which war is conducted, that the war does not spill over, that Russia does not have the capacity, the military might, to attack another country. So I think the Europeans are increasingly concerned that they will have to do that on their own, that they will have to rely on their own resources. They are trying to increase the production of weaponry, but realistically, they still can't match the resources that the US have. So if you know, the US does not help, if the US does not step in, the Europeans alone won't be able in the short term to drastically increase the their preparedness and the number of weapons that they can provide, that they can make, manufacture, or, you know, find or buy here in European soil.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about some of the lies that Trump was saying in that little snippet that we heard. For one, there is no quote unquote dues that, you know, or you pay your dues or we don't protect you. That's just simply not true. So a lot of folks are unaware of that. Now, what is true is that Europe, mainly Western Europe, Europeans in particular, over the years, have failed to invest in their own security. That part is definitely true. Now, the thing is that a lot of these countries have since increased. And honestly, Trump did put a fire under him, but he was not the first person to say that Europe needs to pay their fair share. That's another thing. He comes in saying that, oh, it was me and the money started pouring in. It didn't really start with you, Trump. You know, this you know, Mr. White supremacist. It actually actually preceded him, and other presidents were bringing this up. Now, Obama in 2015 also stressed the importance of Western European countries, particularly to contribute their fair share. We're going to listen to a clip of Obama stressing this now.
The situation in Ukraine reminds us that our freedom isn't free, and we've got to be willing to pay for the assets, the personnel, the training that's required to make sure that we have a credible NATO force and an effective deterrent force.
So he was talking about this. Now, Obama wasn't as much of a jerk as Trump was in irresponsibly saying that we're going to withdraw from the alliance if you don't do it. But the point is that there are other presidents who stressed this. Now, a country that's really been ratcheting up has been Poland. Poland has been ratcheting up its military production. And then we also know, because of this second invasion, Sweden and Finland are now members, and so they're the 31st and 32nd members of NATO right now. And so I want to ask you, you know, I feel like there's a major difference between the way that Eastern European countries think about their security in NATO versus Western European countries. And there has never been a general secretary of NATO from a country that was formerly colonized by Russia, i.e. ex-USSR, former Warsaw Pact country. Do you feel like there would be a different response if a Eastern European or a Ukrainian would presume would take over the general secretary post of NATO? And do you notice this difference between how Eastern Europeans and Western Europeans view this threat?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just look at Estonia. When Trump says that Europeans do not spend enough, it does not apply to all European countries. Countries such as Estonia has been spending about 6% of its GDP on defense. You know, it's an example to all the other European countries to take their defense seriously and to contribute a fair share and to, you know, increase what they contribute to defense and to NATO. So an Estonian candidate for the general secretary of NATO was discussed, Kaja Kallas. She is amazing. You know, I admire her. She's one of my role models as well. And the way she speaks so frankly about the situation, about the Russian threat, about, you know, the need not to back down, not to be intimidated by Russia, I think it is really important. And, you know, I'm so sorry to hear that so many countries inside NATO actually don't want her to be the NATO Secretary General explicitly because of that, right? There was a recent article by Politico in which one Western European official was quoted as saying that they don't want her because she eats, I quote him, she eats Russians for breakfast. So she is seen as someone who is very radical. Yeah, and a lot of people reacted to that by saying, well, what's wrong with that? You know, that she would be a perfect NATO Secretary General in a situation when Russia is a threat, when Russia is, you know, waging the biggest war in Europe since the World War II, killing civilians, wiping out cities out of the face of Earth, and generally denying the right to exist to a neighboring sovereign and independent state, and saying that they will not stop there. You know, Dmitry Medvedev showed a map with the slogan "Russian borders no end nowhere," and the map that included most of Ukraine's territory as part of Russia. So, I mean, Russia is serious about what it is doing. The Russians are very serious about what their goals are. They are explicit about it. They are not hiding that. So it doesn't really make sense to kind of have very naive expectations that somehow if the West does not escalate, Russia will stop, can be appeased in a way. No, we have to get real. We have to deal with Russia, not of our imagination or, you know, of our wishful thinking, but the real Russia, the way it is. And as I said, it doesn't hide its real intentions. It doesn't hide what it wants.
People
like Kaja Kallas, who have this very clear understanding of, you know, what the threat is, what has to be done, and also the importance of not being intimidating, and also like what she says about the strength, you know, that still the collective West is much stronger and has much more resources than Russia. It's just mostly psychological warfare that the West somehow is weaker than Russia because they let themselves to be intimidated. And many countries out of this fear of escalation, they don't do things that actually do lead to escalation because the inaction in case of Russia that acts as a bully very often leads to an escalation more than action, more than a response, more than, you know, very proactive, assertive response to Russia's action.
Yeah, and I was going to add to that. Russia is operating on a wartime economy, whereas we in the NATO countries are not. And I think that's a big difference. And so the Russian population is psychologically in a war state, even though they officially are not calling it that. But the way that Putin talks, I call him a Russian supremacist. I think that he is an extremely dangerous person in the same vein as Donald Trump. And he is operating on this siege mentality. They're out to get us. They're out to get us. They're trying to destroy us, right? And so Putin wants to protect Russianness. He wants, his mentality is the Russian people, our existence is at, you know, is suffering from an existential threat. And we all know that that's bullshit, but that's what he's doing. And it's this very Russian nationalist sentiment that is fueling Russians' resolve to believe that the Ukrainians are primarily at fault for this war, and the West is aiding and abetting them. And that's why this whole narrative of Nazis in Ukraine resonates with people. It really reminds me of the same way that Donald Trump operates here. He picks a group of people, he attacks them. It may not be a physical war. With us, it's immigrants, it's undocumented people, and it's Black people, it's minority groups. I think that they both, Donald Trump and Putin, are racist in their own ways. I think Putin hates Ukraine. I think that in his own little way, he racializes Ukrainians. And I've listened to enough of him speak to really get that idea. You know, and especially if you listen to Dmitry Medvedev's telegram or read it, it's a straight up ethnic cleansing scribe of Ukrainians. And the ways that people think about, the ways that anti-Semitic people think about taking out Jewish people or people who are Islamophobic, that's the way that Dmitry Medvedev talks. He is like the official mouthpiece of Russia when it comes to that, as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, I definitely, before I we get off, I want to talk to you about, you know, another, going on to something else that I find really interesting about you, is we've known each other, I don't know how long. I wonder if has it been 10 years, maybe?
Yeah,
maybe,
well,
not that long.
Not in person, but yeah, if we consider the online communication, then yeah, around 10 years, I think.
Yeah. So basically, even though we've met several times in person, right, in Kyiv, but I am really interested in how Ukrainians are responding to a lot of the issues that are happening around the world, and in this conversation about building solidarity. And you spoke about a recent trip to South Africa. Well, it was last summer, and you were telling me about how you learned about European colonialism and how it really shaped your mind, and especially in times when Ukraine is asking the world for support, you and a lot of other people have been talking about what it means to build with other groups of people, with other, you know, with oppressed people. And I really want to hear you talk about that, because we never discussed that trip, and I want to talk about how much it shaped you and changed you.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, also I want to thank you for opening my mind to a lot of issues that I was not familiar with, you know, with what the Black people face. And I admit that I might have been a racist in the past, because I just wasn't aware of many things that, you know, Black people are facing. And so thank you so much for, like, having very friendly conversations, very patient conversations with me, and, like, explaining things that I wasn't aware of, because I admit that, being born and raised in a multi-ethnic country, but mostly white country that Ukraine is, it somehow makes you really not realize the privileges of white people, makes you really not very much aware of what people of color in various parts of the world are going through. So I've been trying to educate myself and to inform myself about that more. And in that sense, this trip to South Africa was very enlightening, because I came there not just to talk about Ukraine, but to listen to people and to learn more about the history of this country. So I talked, you know, at two universities, at the University of Pretoria and at the University, Wits University of Johannesburg, with students. And I really was curious to hear, you know, their thoughts. So I encouraged them to ask me questions after my talks about Ukraine. But I also, you know, spoke with them after the events, just like privately, to understand like their experiences and what their concerns are and what they think about the state of play in the world, you know, not just Ukraine, but in general. So it was very, very educational from then that point of view. I used also this trip to go to the Museum of Apartheid, and that probably one of the best museums I've ever visited, because it's also such an eye-opener. I read the autobiography of Nelson Mandela a couple of years ago, so before the Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And, you know, by reading it, I already saw how much in common there is between, you know, the struggle of Nelson Mandela and people in South Africa against apartheid, and the struggle of other people who were oppressed by imperial colonial powers, and, you know, even the struggle in some aspects of Ukrainians under Russian Empire or under, you know, Soviet Empire. Of course, there are a lot of differences, but there are also some similarities. So it was very interesting to find those similarities during this trip to South Africa, to hear, you know, from the scholars there also how they see the similarities and where they see differences, and also about the sensitivities that exist, that not all things can be compared, that not all the narratives that we Ukrainians use to explain our struggle can resonate with people in other countries. So for example, a narrative which does not resonate in Africa is that Ukraine is fighting for European values, because for Ukraine, European values are democracy, freedom, but for people in Africa, European values are oppression, are colonialism, are, you know, deprivation of rights and genocide in countries like Congo. So a very, very different understanding and perception of this thing. So I think it's very important to just listen to other people and their, you know, history and the way they perceive things, to be aware of these sensitivities, because yes, there are a lot of differences, but I also think there are a lot of things in common and something that, you know, we can find common ground on. It's just that we really, I think we as Ukrainians still do not have enough knowledge of Africa, or, you know, the struggle of Black people in general and across the world. And likewise, people in Africa, they are more exposed to the Russian version of history of Ukraine and what is going on in Ukraine, just because of, you know, the historical links, because of this habit of associating Russia with the Soviet Union, although Ukraine was a part of the Soviet Union. So arguably, if they perceive Soviet Union as a good power, well, then it does not necessarily mean that Russia equals Soviet Union. Then maybe the sympathy could also be extended to Ukraine, which was a part of the Soviet Union. And for example, in Crimea, some the most prominent people who fought against apartheid in South Africa, they were trained in Crimea, which was a part of Ukraine in, you know, in the Soviet times when they were trained there. So just like talking about this and learning more about each other, I think it's so important.
It is, definitely. And I really feel like it's my responsibility as somebody who devotes so much of my time to Ukraine, lives in Ukraine, studies Ukraine, to be patient with people, because I feel like people have been patient with me in my own growth process. And another thing is that I know not everyone can exercise that patience. So that's the reason why I do it. I feel like I'm called to do it. And if anything that I said helped you in any way, I'm really thankful for it, because it means that we have one more person that can help us all talk about the need of us being invested in each other's safety and security, because that's what I want, right? And I'm happy that you brought up that point about the conversation about European values and how that doesn't resonate. And I do believe that Ukrainians generally, not just Ukrainians, but most people, they don't understand how to have these types of conversations with people from the continent, or Black people in general, because we all are fighting oppression, but the way that it impacts us is different. And sometimes it conflicts, right? There are clashes. And so I'm one of those people who say, well, definitely Ukraine needs to be a part of NATO. But at the same time, I support NATO, but I understand that NATO's actions in countries that are led by people that have people of color predominantly I can understand how they may see that as a very adversarial military entity, and they'll be correct about that. And so I think it's perfectly okay for us to work through that. And I think that's the most dangerous thing about oppression, is that there are a lot of examples that can easily make us square off against each other, as opposed to us doing the very difficult work and really stepping outside of our comfort zones like you did, and going to South Africa and learning how to have those conversations, because it's not impossible to do. We just have to have the open mind to do the necessary work and care about things beyond ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the thing that I was like, that struck me was that there was so much interest, you know, I almost didn't expect that much interest to Ukraine on behalf of the people that I met there. So I thought, you know, it's so important. People really want to understand what is happening. They want to, and they are ready, you know, to question the narratives that they are being fed by their own government, which has, you know, relationship with Russia. South Africa is a part of BRICS and just hosted the BRICS summit, you know, before I arrived there, so there were all these banners everywhere, and you know, they also have like vested economic interests. Russian oligarchs are present there with the capital, you know, working very closely with the local oligarchs and the local politicians. But at the level of civil society, you know, students, journalists, and like other people that I met were mostly representatives of civil society. I noted that there was a lot of like interest, curiosity, and also very like critical thinking. So South Africa is a democracy. It is a flawed democracy. There are almost no perfect democracies. The US is far from a perfect democracy, right? You will agree with me on that. So, but it is a democracy. I think it is important. It is an important point because it means I saw that people are, you know, they are free to question what they are being told. They are not afraid to ask questions. They are not afraid to be challenging. Students were challenging their professors, which I really liked. I think it's a healthy academic environment if students feel empowered enough to challenge their professors. So, you know, when there is this openness and the desire to know and the curiosity, then there is space for a dialogue, then there is space for cooperation. And if I can contribute in some way to that, I'm very happy.
How did it come about that you went on this trip? Because I think more Ukrainians need to do it.
Well, that was an invitation of my acquaintance, who is an academic and who is South African, but who is not living there anymore. So basically this person arranged it. It was not very easy, and even to persuade the universities to hold, you know, an event. It was not just dedicated to Ukraine, actually, or to Russia's war in Ukraine. So the title was Intersections of Oppression. And the participants, like various speakers, academics from different countries, they spoke about the experience of Africa, the experience of fight against oppression in Africa and various parts of Africa, not just in South Africa. And then there were representatives and like academics and diplomats from Eastern Europe and Central Europe, not just Ukrainians, but there was someone from Czech Republic, from Lithuania. And it turned out that, you know, there are a lot of these intersections of oppression, that there are a lot of common experience to share and to discuss. And I thought it was a very eye-opening discussion. Also, I saw it from the reaction of the audience that, you know, many people didn't realize how much in common there was in the experience of the countries of Central and Eastern Europe that suffered from Russian oppression, from, you know, Russian imperialism and the oppressed people in Africa.
Yeah, because I'll tell you, as somebody who's currently traveling the country and talking about Ukraine, I go to at least one university per week. I've been doing that for the past month and a half or so, and I have about 7 more universities to visit. And my last, there's a Ukrainian community in Philadelphia that's working to organize an event for me to come down. And they, one of the people who they're trying to work with is a Black state senator who introduced a bill that would work to divest from Russian business entities in these, you know, in Pennsylvania. And what's interesting is that this state senator's father also led the divestment movement in Philadelphia for the city to divest from apartheid South Africa during the 1980s. And so this was a Black political leader in Philadelphia who had these kind of intersectional links between what's going on domestically and abroad. And his son, Sharif Street, is doing that in the case of Ukraine. And so there are examples here in the United States of that solidarity coming together. And so there are people who have open minds and open hearts who are willing to do that. So I feel like it's up to us to amplify those voices and be the model for everyone else. And I'm just really happy that you're the model for Ukraine, because we need more people like you. We need more people who don't mind going to South Africa. I haven't been to South Africa. Most people, even if they had the invitation, wouldn't go in with the mindset and the openness to have that. Because I think that actually makes Ukraine a lot stronger. The ability to understand what it is. And also the ability to look at Europe and say, you know what? Your European values are not ones that should universally be celebrated, because they aren't. Because your past and your present has things to work on. And so Ukraine can do both things. You can walk and chew bubble gum at the same time. You can be a NATO member. You can have NATO support, which I support. But you can also be critical of ways in which the Europeans have historically and currently engaged. And I'm happy that you are one of those key voices leading that. You're making a world of difference.
Thank you so much, Terrell. No, I'm pleased. I'm always happy to have these conversations with you, because I think they are so much, you know, like they are very eye-opening, and they are really like widening my perspective. And I think it's so important to think about different people we are talking to, because Ukrainians were for a very long time focused only on Western audiences, which I think was a mistake. It is so important, you know, to talk to people from across the world, and even those people in the West, which are not the majority, you know, that are also feeling under pressure, that are feeling oppressed, that are still, you know, being facing like a lot of challenges in their countries, sometimes even on behalf of, you know, this country's leaders or the candidates to be leaders. So I think, yeah, there is so much in common. And this openness to a different perspective is so valuable.
And I am so happy that we can end the show on that note, because I really want my work in Ukraine, the journalism that I do, I travel around the country and I do feature stories. I talk to people about their lives. But really what this is about is that I want us to all be invested in each other's security and in each other's safety. And I'm crazy enough to believe that that can actually happen. And I spend my time talking to different groups of people, especially Black people. I talk to Black people about Ukraine. And I talk to my own community about, hey, these are some things that you're getting wrong, right? And so you're doing that I'm doing that on my end, you're doing that on your end. And so we want more people in our communities to do that. And that's going to contribute to the peace that we can all collectively live in together. But thank you so much, Olga. You have always been great. And I'm going to do everything that I can to ensure with my vote that Joe Biden wins, because I'm telling you, it's not going to just suck for Ukraine. It's going to suck for me too. And everybody else, if this maniacal white supremacist wins, I'm scared. You say Ukrainians aren't scared of death. I am.
Yeah, well, I understand. But, you know, actually, I wanted to ask you one thing. I noticed that Trump was using AI to, you know, manufacture these images of like Black people allegedly supporting his campaign. So is he like, what's that about? Is he trying to reach out to like people of color in that way?
So Olga, first of all, did you see? I'll explain that. But did you see him try to hawk his sneakers, like the Trump sneaker? Did you see that?
No.
Okay, so Donald Trump, he has this very cartoonish attitude about Black people where if you play rap music at the rallies or if you show them sneakers, just all seriously, he does this, right? And so he has the most stereotypical ways in which he thinks that he can attract Black voters. And the reality of it is that in this country, there's always been about 10 to 12% of Black people that vote Republican. And that has preceded him. They will vote Republican no matter what. As far as that AI, yeah, there are different groups that produce these AI images with Black people because they want to give the image that Black people are generally into him. And the reality of it, that's just not true. Black people overwhelmingly vote Democrat at, you know, 90%. And so he's never going to get the Black vote. Now, he does have a small contingency of Black people that support him, but they're the most extreme people that you will ever meet. I'll put it to you this way. Prime example. I don't know if you have this in Ukrainian culture or Ukrainian language, but in like with Black people, one of the worst things you can call a Black person is a sellout. And what that means is a Black person who sells out their race and their dignity for the sake of whiteness. Now, the only example that I can think of in Ukraine is Viktor Yanukovych, right?
Yeah, we have actually that thing. It's called Malorossi. So Ukrainians who kind of renounce their Ukrainian identity to embrace Russian and this kind of, you know, great Russian approach to all the other countries which are lesser in their opinion. Yeah, it rings a bell. You see another thing in common.
Okay, so here's the thing. If you call somebody a sellout, it's like fighting words because it's like, you know, and we have other words that we, you know, that Black people use, but like a sellout is like if you have some pride in yourself, if you want to insult somebody, call them a sellout, right? But, you know, those are the people who I, you know, who generally tend to support Trump because Trump doesn't do anything for Black people. Donald Trump in the 1970s, he refused to rent to Black people. He was sued by the Department of Justice and lost. And Michael Cohen, his former attorney who testified against him and is continuing to testify against him, said that Trump would regularly say racist things about Black people. And the Black people who support him, who have Blacks for Trump or N-words for Donald Trump, those are the people that would sell us into slavery. Just how Viktor Yanukovych back in 2014 asked that the Russian army come in and save him. Like those types of people, right? And we call it sellout. And what do you call it in Ukrainian?
It's a bit different, but it's malorossi. It's like someone who has an inferiority complex because of their identity. So they want to, you know, kind of reject it and embrace an identity which is of this greater Russia. Malorossi basically means lesser Russian.
Okay, but it's the same. No, it's the same thing. Because the Black people who support Trump and who actually okay his behavior very much have low self-esteem and issues with their identity, and they embrace whiteness. So this Ukrainian variant embrace Russianness. And the Black people who do this embrace whiteness. They're the same people. They would get along very well together. But for that AI, for that, because, and also too, and here, a lot of the Trump supporters, they say that Putin is not the problem. Zelensky is the problem. There are people who have gone on record on CNN and have said this. So It's one of those things where there's just this collective ecosystem of white supremacists, Russian supremacists, self-hate. And the person that culminates all this together in the media form is Tucker Carlson, who does it very effectively. And so this AI, it works because if you don't pay attention, you think that those photos are real. And so and it doesn't attract Black people in the way that most people think that it would. It just reinforces with the people who already support Trump that Black people do. So people like me and most people, most 90% of Black people think it's bullshit. But for those hard, rabid people who will support Donald Trump regardless of whatever racist stuff that he says and does, that is going to appeal to them. And his sneakers for $400, because you may not know this, but in the state of New York, where I'm at right now, Tish James, our attorney general, has led a case against him where he has to pay roughly $500 million because he committed fraud by lying about his property values in the state of New York. And so, and she's a Black woman. And so all of the people, interestingly enough, that are suing him in the United States, in Georgia, here in New York, at the state level and local level, they're Black people. So when you think about the people who are upholding and defending our democracy, it's Black people who he hates. And they are the ones that are holding him accountable. So that's just an interesting thing. But that AI, most Black people ain't going for it, but a lot of people are.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. But
that's
anyway,
a topic for another discussion, I think.
Yeah, for another discussion. Oh, absolutely. But listen, Olga, thank you so much. I'm happy that you are safe. I'm happy that you're really, being a leader in just your field, and you're in Chatham House. And I encourage everybody to follow you on Twitter. I will never call it X.
Although I almost stopped sharing anything there, but yeah, occasionally I still am.
Okay, yeah, and also the whole thing with mental health, because we have to talk about the fact that Ukrainians, while they're strong people, they're humans, and we're all humans, and we all need to get our mental health check. I do it. I am a yoga person who enjoys yoga and ways to decompress. In fact, there's a great hot yoga spot on Maidan that I'm going to go to that a Ukrainian recommended I'm going to check out. But anyway, thank you so much, Olga. You've been great as always.
Thank you, Terrell. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. And so, guys, thank you very much for listening, and tune in next week. Bygones, be bygones, with bygones and spray. Tired of biting.